It's time for the Arts and Culture of Western Wisconsin, the people, places, and performances. Yes, it's time for Spectrum West. Hi, everybody. I'm Al Ross. This week, the 6th annual Eau Claire Improv Festival is drawing near, and today we have special guests, Amber Dernbach, who helps organize it and also hones young improv talent, as well as Vernon Mina, a performer with Chicago's The Second City, sending their all-stars to perform in this year's festival. Friday night's going to be funktacular for those who attend the State Theater backstage concert by the Chippewa Valley Jazz Orchestra. Jeff Peterson, one of the wonderful noisemakers, stopped by to chat. Jim Oliver's two-headed contribution features What's on Stage in Western Wisconsin and some dialogue with Wayne Merrick, director of the Eau Claire Children's Theater, production of Charlotte's Web, the musical. We have some Spectrum memos to toss in as well, and here's our point of embarkation. Photography continues to evolve as an art form thanks to dedication to the craft by people like John Greger. He takes pictures, but he also takes taking pictures to a new level. And he shares what he knows within workshops and adventures through a mentoring entity known as Cold Snap, operating out of Two Harbors, Minnesota. He's bringing back what he knows to share with those who'd also like to know in a photographic workshop at the Phipps Center in Hudson. I learn many things doing this program, and in researching this conversation, one of the revelations is in education. You have a degree with a title that made me think I could have designed something that fit me perfectly rather than select something everyone else was taking. Your Bachelor of Arts degree, and I will ask you about the program as well, was a combined degree in social sciences and fine art photography titled Documentary Expression of American Culture Through Photography. Now, I'm not well-schooled in post-secondary prospects, but just the title alone tells me that you were pretty sharply focused on what you wanted to do in life. Is that true?
Yeah, I'd say that's probably true. I knew that photography was going to be a big part of my life and my career. I certainly wasn't looking for a degree for vocational purposes. I was looking at it as more of a lifestyle.
Well, remaining in the halls of education, your master's degree is in education with an emphasis on photographic literacy. And that term opens another can of scholastic worms for me. Being photographically literate is very interesting. It takes looking at a photo to a whole new level. I found a website. It's called photopedagogy, whichever way you want to pronounce it, .com. And once there, if you enter the term photo literacy in the search box, a wonderful page pops up. Describe, if you can, in a thumbnail fashion for our audience, what photographic literacy is.
Well, I think it's, as you say, taking the understanding of a photographic image to a higher level. It's curious to me that from the moment we enter school, we're taught in a very formal fashion proper diction, proper grammar, how to spell, how to write, how to communicate in a written word. But it's assumed that we gather through osmosis or something an understanding of visual communication. And in particular, for me, my interest was photographic communication. So we kind of leave all that to happenstance. But yet, when you think of the amount of photographs that we consume every day and digest and translate and come to an understanding, it far exceeds the written word. So the idea of looking at it as how can we break this down into more of a formal learning process was what was of interest to me. And it runs across the board. There's a lot of different stuff involved with that, not only the design of a photograph and what works visually, the technique of how you achieve that with modern cameras, as well as the legal aspects. Copyright and ownership and use on social media and internet, all of those facets of it were fascinating.
Rather than walking around taking photographs of attractive things and capturing moments, your projects have been very specific, and that fits with the unambiguous title of the FIPS course that you are putting on in April. We'll get to that in a bit. But you've devoted time to things like taking horse racing photos, kayak adventures, horse-mounted military musical bands, natural areas in Minnesota, and you've produced several books. Is it correct to say, John, that in order for a photographer to really capture something, he has to know what he's looking for or want to understand something before he trips the shutter? He needs a photograph to reveal something about a subject.
Certainly that's my style, or that's my approach. I enjoy learning about the subject even before I go out to photograph, although a lot of times it's sort of, I do it in fits and starts. I might go out and photograph something that intrigues me, and through that photograph become more interested in that subject, and then go out and research more and go photograph more, research more, and go photograph more. That's typically the way I do it. Part of the time is spent hitting the books and learning about the subject. Part of the time is out in the field photographing it.
Okay.
And a lot of times I might be just taking photographs without any idea of a specific subject, but something about one particular photograph leads me further down that path and excites me and gets me going on a particular subject that I want to delve into more.
Uh-huh. On the phone with John Greger, he is the proprietor of Cold Snap. He's a resident of Two Harbors, Minnesota, although at this moment we're talking to him in Utah, somewhere a lot warmer than Two Harbors, Minnesota. I did notice there's a golf course in Two Harbors, so it can't be all bad. The topic specifically, other than what he does and how he does it, which is fascinating to talk about, is a photography workshop coming to the FIPS Center in Hudson, April 20th through the 22nd. Modern cameras, you used that term a little while ago. Although you use, you know, the modern stuff, the digital SLRs, and toys, and bells and whistles that are out there for editing, etc. And you sent me a supplementary document in which you say, I reject the notion of streamlining my workflow. Are you old enough to have used the other stuff prior to all the digital stuff?
Yes, I photographed for many years. In fact, I was a late comer to digital and digital photography, in part because of the subject that I photographed. I did a lot of garden photography and architecture photography commercially, and at that time, and certainly even to a certain extent now, those subject matters don't require immediate turnaround. So I worked with conventional photographic processes, and I worked with view cameras in particular, the old-style cameras where you go under the dark cloth to compose the photograph, because the subject matter dictated that sort of approach. Yeah, I have probably 30 years of photographic experience in conventional film processes before I switched to digital.
The document you sent supplementarily also gets into, and there's a whole bunch of lines in which you describe how you get ready to take a photograph. And after I read that and then got to the following line, which reads, then I open the shutter and let go of the process. I never know what the final image will look like. On this program, I talk to a lot of artists. That sentence sounds a lot like what potters say after they get done shaping something and they put it in the kiln, and the kiln does wonderful things to it. It's an interesting similarity. I mean, that's really true. You never know what the final image will look like.
To a certain degree, yeah. I mean, in photography, there's a whole approach or genre of work. I mean, the famous person that implemented it at first and really defined the workflow of it was Ansel Adams with his zone system, and he was a big proponent of pre-visualizing the image before you made it. I do that to a certain degree. I spend a lot of time carefully considering exactly how I'm going to arrange this photograph, what's included, what isn't included, how long I'm going to expose the image for, those sorts of things, which all affect it. But I like to play around with long exposures on a lot of my work, especially up on Lake Superior, where you have the motion and movement of water that can affect so much of the image. When you start doing images that are exposed several seconds to several minutes long, you don't know exactly how the final thing is going to turn out. And so you do all that careful preparation. You hope that you put everything together in a way that's going to be pleasing. But at a certain point, you have to let go of it and just see what happens.
Mm-hmm. That's the voice of John Greger. He's a photographer, and he's putting on a photography workshop at the Phipps Center coming up in April. John, I've taken some pretty great photos with my phone. Does that irk you, or does that delight you?
It delights me. I've taken some great photographs with my phone, too. The best camera that you can use is the one you've got, and a lot of times that's the one you've got. The big failing with phones tends to be if you start to reproduce them outside of a digitally viewable environment where you go to print, they may not look so great anymore.
I think the reason that the photos are so good is that they are spontaneous, and you don't always have a camera with you when the coolest things happen. Now we do.
Right.
We could talk for a long time on what you do and how you do it, but let's hone in on the workshop at the Phipps. It's called Landscape Light, Capturing the Heart of the River. What's going to happen to people who take this workshop?
This workshop is a nice opportunity for people to be able to take their skill levels a little bit further. So many photographers may know or understand how to get a good image that looks good on the back of the camera, but then taking those next steps and taking it all the way out to print remains a bit of a mystery, or they struggle with it. And this workshop takes them from the very beginning, from the beginning concept through to a print. So they learn each part of that process, how their camera works, what the best way to approach the subject is, and the best sort of exposure and digital file to create to then take it to the next step, which is to put it onto a computer and then print it onto a piece of paper.
That's the photographic process. Now, you're educated in photography. Can a guy like you teach someone to have an eye for a great photo, or is part of that need to be an innate talent?
I can teach you the technique, how to do everything from arranging elements in the viewfinder so that it looks pleasing, to create the right depth of field, the right emphasis on focus, and the right content as far as exposure. I can't teach you passion for a subject. That has to come from you.
Yeah, well, you guys who are going to take part in the photography workshop at the Phipps Center are in for a real treat. John Greger is the guy who's going to be mentoring you, and it is, again, April 20th through the 22nd. If you want more information on it, and I would guess after listening to this, you may, thephipps.org is the website. That's PHIPPS.org. John, you want to push your website?
Sure, thank you. Website is coldsnap.com. I also have a presence on Instagram under John Greger, or Facebook under either John Greger or Cold Snap Photography.
John Greger, thanks for being with us on Spectrum West and Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thanks, Al. Appreciate it.
Yet to come on Spectrum West, the Improv Festival with special guests, and remembering that funk is always with us. Plus, Jim Oliver is waiting in the wings. Support for WPR comes from Chanhassen Dinner Theaters, performing Disney's new Broadway musical, Newsies, presented by Star Tribune. A high-energy song and dance celebration. More information is available at chanhassendt.com. Support also comes from the Minnesota Marine Art Museum in Winona, presenting multiple exhibitions annually, while home to art inspired by water, including Washington Crossing the Delaware by artist Emmanuel Leutze, mmam.org. Willie Porter going there in the background. Time for Jim Oliver to step in with this week's adaptation of He's Oliver That, and today it's a classic put to music.
Careless Web is a stage musical based on a children's book by E.B. White. White wrote three acclaimed children's books, Stuart Little, published in 1945, Charlotte's Web in 1952, and The Trumpet of the Swan in 1970. The stage version was written by White and Joseph Robinette, with music and lyrics by Charles Strauss. It premiered in Wilmington, Delaware in 1989. The Eau Claire Children's Theater will present Charlotte's Web Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, April 6th, 7th, and 8th at the State Theater in Eau Claire. Here to talk about the show is Wayne Merrick, founder, executive director of the Children's Theater, and director of the play. Well, curtain times for the performances are 7:30 Friday, 10 a.m. and 1:30 p.m. Saturday, and 1:30 p.m. Sunday. At noon Saturday, there's something called the Barnyard Bash. So what's that all about?
For many of the kid family shows, we have an added experience, which is usually an hour before one of the matinees for Charlotte's Web. At noon on that Saturday before the 1:30 performance, we have the Barnyard Bash. And all of the added experiences are similar in format. Theater games, crafts and games that are related to the show. There's treats and things like that. And then participants get to meet the cast before the show and get pictures and things like that. So it's just some fun activities before the show. And we do that probably 5-6 times a year with mostly the younger kid shows.
Now, I'm pretty sure this is a kid show.
Definitely a family show, yes.
Yeah, family show, yeah. Is it something adults will enjoy?
We've done the non-musical version probably 3 times now in our history. This will be the first time we've done the musical version because it's a little bit newer. It has been a perennial favorite for our audiences. It's just a classic book. You know, it's still beloved, and you hate to use those terms lightly, but, you know, classic. It's a beloved children's book, but it fits the bill all the way around. It's just, you know, one of people's favorites books. They continue to read it to their kids. They read it in school. It's just got a great message and a great story, and it's just so well known. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's definitely a great family show. Like with most of our shows, you know, really, who cares if you have kids or not? If you want to come see Charlotte's Web, even if you don't have kids. And we certainly have lots of adults that come to our shows without kids.
Sure. Tell us about the story.
I think everybody, you know, with the different movie versions and cartoon versions and the stage versions and the book, I think there's probably not many people that don't know the story. But it's, in a nutshell, the story of Wilbur, the young runt pig, who is saved by Fern and, you know, goes to live at the Zuckerman farm and finds out that there's a you know, conspiracy with farm animals that often they're going to be made into food. So he gets wind of that. And, of course, he befriends Charlotte the spider, who helps save him by weaving words into her web, you know, some pig and radiant and terrific and things like that. They take him to the fair, and of course, he wins a special prize because of how amazing he is and, you know, what a miracle this is. But really, the whole, you know, the bottom line of the story is the unique friendship between a pig and a spider and accepting people for their differences and getting along. Everybody just really latches on to the friendship, you know, moral of the story. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why it's so endearing and enduring. That's why people like it.
Sure. Now, this has a really big cast.
It is a large cast. Yeah. It, you know, it has all of the characters that you know from the book with Wilbur and Charlotte and, you know, the talking animals, of course, the, you know, goose and a gander and a sheep and a lamb. And, of course, then the humans, Fern and her family and the Zuckermans. And then there's a large chorus of townspeople and fairgoers and young people that play barnyard animals and human characters when they go to the fair.
Is this one of those shows where you can kind of expand or contract it depending upon how many kids you show up?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, you could certainly do it with a smaller cast of animals. Mm-hmm. You know, for example, you could have just the lead animals and just a few extras or not. And we have quite a large cast of kids in the show, you know, and then a nice core of adults.
Mm-hmm. We are talking to Wayne Merrick, who is the director of the Eau Claire Children's Theater production of Charlotte's Web. You want to talk about the principal actors? I don't
sure.
run down the cast. But
yeah. Well, I mean, the main leads, of course, are Fern, Fern, Charlotte, and Wilbur, and really those are the big three.
Sure.
Because it is a musical, we've got some people that have had, you know, quite a bit of musical experience, even though they're, you know, 10 and 12, you know, 13-year-olds, they're young. Castle Dettinger is Wilbur, who has had a number of leads with us, probably most recently James and the Giant Peach, you know, a number of leads there. Taya, who's playing Fern, was our Annie last fall. So, you know, quite a large role last fall. So she's back in a, you know, another starring role. Ava Schultz is Charlotte. Probably her largest role recently was in Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe. So all the lead kids have had large roles, and most of them in large singing roles. So, and that's really one of the reasons for doing this version. It's a musical, and it's different than the non-musicals that we've done. Yeah, different because it's a musical. The story is always the same. The script is almost, you know, exactly the same. But the music by Charles Strauss, like you mentioned, great music by a well-known composer, same guy who did the music for Annie, Bye Bye Birdie, those kinds of things. So a well-known Broadway composer.
Now, do you have a pit orchestra and a musical director and all?
Right, it's a small, it's written for a small combo. So, you know, a keyboard, synthesizer, you know, piano, bass, drums, that kind of a combo. So that's the, you know, orchestration for it. So, you know, six, seven people. And that fits the music, I guess, because it is, there's, you know, there's a, of course, a country-ish hoedown number for the animals to, you know, welcome Wilbur and stuff like that. So that's really what you need for the music.
In perusing your webpage, which I do regularly, I appreciate it very much. And I also appreciate, by the way, getting the weekly updates.
That we've got quite a large group of people that get the weekly updates, and I think that, that does help to keep people in, you know, connected to us.
Well, anyway, I found that you are really up to your armpits in theater classes.
Right.
You want to talk about that? Right. How that's going?
I can't even remember when we started. I think 1994 maybe was the first year of summer classes. So we've been doing summer classes for many years. There's usually, you know, 25, 30 some classes each summer for ages 3 to 18. And there's kind of a wide variety of classes. There's acting classes, performance-based classes, technical theater classes, show choir, dance, just a lot of classes for different ages. And the brochure is there. And we do have partnerships with the Eau Claire and Chippewa Falls school districts, where the school district will pay the registration fee for students in their districts. So that makes it pretty attractive to parents looking for a summer class.
Oh, sure. Now, I noticed also you're looking for interns.
We are. Every summer we have anywhere between three and six interns for the summer. And that's spread across the whole, whatever, theatrical spectrum, put it that way. So it's, you know, costumes and tech theater, but then also the support stuff, education, marketing, graphic design, things like that. So we're wrapping that up next week. And we usually bring in, like I said, maybe three to six interns, almost all from out of state.
Oh. Well, like, for instance, where would they be coming from?
We post on different job boards around the country and a lot of the college websites or job boards for college students. We've had, couldn't even list all the states, but you know, last year our tech intern was from Virginia, education intern from Pennsylvania. You know, so they see the postings, and you know, they're looking for an internship, and they're willing to hop in their car or whatever, and you know, drive across the country for the summer and hang out with us for the, you know, for the 12-week internship. So
great. Well, the play is Charlotte's Web, a musical based on the children's book of the same name written by E.B. White. We've been talking to the director, Wayne Merrick. The show runs Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, April 6th, 7th, and 8th at the State Theater in Eau Claire. For ticket information, check the Children's Theater webpage at www.ecct.org. Wayne Merrick, thanks so much for coming in to
talk
to us.
And for the record, we seldom let Jim out of the building before sharing what's on stage in Western Wisconsin. Mr. Oliver, the stage is still yours.
Thank you, sir. Once Upon a Mattress, a fractured fairy tale musical comedy, will be performed Friday and Saturday at the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson. The Clear Lake Community Theater will present The Addams Family April 6th through the 8th and the 13th through the 15th in the Clear Lake Community Center. Don't Hug Me, We're Family will run Fridays and Saturdays at the St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater in Hudson. The show will run through May 19th. The musical Big Fish will be presented by the University of Wisconsin Stout Theater April 6th and 7th, and April 12th to the 14th in the Harvey Hall Theater at the University in Menominee. And the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson has scheduled auditions for The Red Box, a Nero Wolfe mystery based on a novel by Rex Stout, 1 to 3 p.m. Sunday, April 8th, and 7 to 9 p.m. Monday, April 9th, at the Phipps. For Spectrum West, I'm Jim Oliver.
It's been since you got down and got funky. But if it's been a while, then you can refill your depleted funk tank Friday evening. Backstage at the State Theater, thanks to the Chippewa Valley Jazz Orchestra. Here's the definition, the official one. Funk de-emphasizes melody and harmony and brings a strong rhythmic groove of electric bass and drums to the foreground. Oh, yeah, it does. Let's bring Jeff Peterson, CVGL percussionist, to the foreground for some details. So eight seasons? Are you in your ninth, or is this eight?
If you base it on number of shows, if you base it on when we actually started, we first sat down and figured out how to do it, next year's our 10th season.
Right.
You can sell it either way.
The line that I read is, the Chippewa Valley Jazz Orchestra is dedicated to bringing the finest big band jazz to the Chippewa Valley region as both entertaining and educational experiences. For now, let's talk about this concert coming up Friday night. Is the beginning of The Bittersweet, your second-to-last appearance at the State Theater. Final one backstage, yes?
Yeah, well, it's actually our first backstage. We've never done a backstage show before.
First and last.
First and last backstage experience at the State.
Has the State been your exclusive home?
No, we were a couple of other places before the State, but we've been at the State now for 5 years. So this will be the end of a five-year run there, and it's been a lot of fun. We've enjoyed it. But yeah, so we've got two shows left, this one and then a show at the end of April.
And the backstage is kind of neat. I've been to a few of those. It's intimate. It's bigger than you would think.
Yeah. Well, I mean, people are always surprised how much room there is on the stage, because if you've never been up there, you don't get a sense of the scope. But yeah, in theory, you can get about 150 people on there total, and without sort of turning into a mosh pit. So It's definitely smaller in that sense, but it's a chance for us to do some music that we love doing, and we don't get a lot of opportunities to fit into our regular shows. So, yeah, it should be a lot of fun.
I think it's funny, maybe not funny, ha-ha, maybe peculiar, how we might grumble about the dressing rooms and under the stage accommodations, and yet when facing elimination, they don't seem dreadful. They have a friendly, sentimental texture. So the State Theater, and I talked to Nobu about this, and anybody who is saying goodbye to the State Theater, it feels a little different than when it was the only game in town.
I think that's true. I mean, I think it's hard not to be a little nostalgic about it. You know, before we played at the State Theater, you know, we would play shows where there would be 40 people in the audience, and half of them were families of the band members, you know. And so, you know, moving to a venue where we could get, 250, 300 people to show up has been a really fun experience for us. I mean, the State Theater is really where the CBJO has grown into a legitimate organization, an organization that people know about. And working with the staff at ECRAC has been absolutely amazing. They've done so much to help us move forward. You know, and it's not that we're not looking forward to Confluence. Confluence is going to offer us a lot of opportunities. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's hard not to get a little sort of nostalgic about the whole thing.
So you now, just moments ago, touched on the performance evolution of the jazz orchestra. Tell me about the evolution of the orchestra itself. How has it evolved since that first season when you were drawing just family members?
Well, you know, I think a lot of things have happened. One of the things is that we, I think over time, have focused actually more on sort of the educational aspects of it, trying to expose people to music they maybe haven't heard before. When we first started, it was like, okay, well, we need to play some stuff that will bring audience member. We want mm-hmm. people to come. And so make sure we do some, you know, popular stuff that people are more familiar with. And I think we have become more willing to challenge our audience a little bit and present them with music that they will, you know, we're 99% certain they'll still really like, but music they maybe haven't heard. I think the other big thing is, you know, when we first started, we had literally no money. And so, you know, we couldn't afford to bring in guest
and
artists.
And now what, do you have truckloads?
Oh, truckloads, absolutely. Yeah. But, you know, we've been able to, you know, get, you know, grant money and support from the public so we can bring in substantial guest artists. You know, when we our first big guest artist was a trumpet player from the West Coast named Wayne Bergeron, who we're mm-hmm. actually bringing back for our first show at the Confluence. And the CVJO was so broke at the time we brought him in. I remember telling my wife, if we don't sell enough tickets for this, I'm going to have to dip into the equity part of the house in order to pay this guy off, because we didn't know how many people would show up. Would it be 50 or would it be 500? And if it was only 50, there was no way the CVJO could afford it. You know, so I think we've evolved into a much more, you know, a more mature organization in terms of structure, in terms of, you know, having an active board, you know, having sponsorships. There's a lot of things that mm-hmm. make us more of a mature organization over time.
Has the makeup of the jazz orchestra been kind of the same since the beginning, or was it a smaller, much more dedicated core at the beginning?
Well, I mean, it's essentially the same size,
okay.
But the number of there aren't very many of us who are left from the beginning now. I would say there's maybe five of us who are still around from the very start. I mean, we've got a lot of people who've been with the band 4 or 5 years, but if you go back to that real original band, we were much more reliant on, for example, you know, students from UW-Eau Claire to come in and sit in on occasion and things like that. And I think the band has actually become more stable in terms of its membership in the last 4 or 5 years, which is a largely a good thing.
No, you just called it a band. Is it a band or an orchestra?
Well, it's a big band, but we call ourselves the Jazz Orchestra.
Okay,
so,
sure.
Yeah. We don't want to create too much confusion.
And nor do I, so I'll pretend I didn't ask that question.
Okay, that's a good call.
Jeff Peterson with us, Chippewa Valley Jazz Band. No, I'm sorry, Chippewa Valley Jazz Orchestra. Is the
I gotta
topic.
Work with this, really.
Is the topic. Specifically, it's a Friday funktacular backstage show at the State Theater. So, Jeff, tell me about what makes it funktacular.
Well, we're doing something really different, I think. You know, we're doing a sort of a tribute to the great horn bands of the 60s and 70s into the 80s and even into the 90s to some degree. But, you know, Earth, Wind & Fire, Tower of Power, Stevie Wonder, you know, groups like that that were famous for having, you know, big brass sections along with more of a rock, funk, blues. We'll do some Blues Brothers, horn bands. But yeah, it's a chance for us to do music that's more sort of fun and dance oriented. And it's not that all jazz has to be deeply thought provoking, but certainly we've done many shows where we've brought the audience on a journey and said, okay, here's the history of the big band. Let's walk through all of this. This is much more, let's get together and have a good time for a couple of hours and play some of this great music that, I think has been in many ways, I don't want to say forgotten, but, you know, shoved into the clearance rack and, you know, shows up only on oldies stations when in many cases, this is some of the greatest music to ever be popular.
Sure.
So
are they hard charts?
Some of them are really hard. The music by groups, like, especially Tower of Power and Earth, Wind & Fire, there's a lot of technical stuff in there that you don't know it when you hear it. I mean, you just listen to it and go, that's a really cool chart. But the technical skill to actually play some of that, especially for the horn players, is really quite challenging. So, yeah, it's not easy music, but it's fun. And I think fun matters a lot.
Well, I was just going to say 75% of the word funk is fun.
That's a really good point. I had not thought of that.
Yeah. So it is Friday night, 7:30, State Theater. It's backstage, and the configuration is kind of neat because you come in one of the side doors and you go down the steps and you come into the backstage area. They have a little kiosk where you can get an adult beverage, and the lighting is neat, and it's just a lot of fun. Then, coming in April, it's the State Theater Swan Song for you. I know you're doing some of your greatest hits. I don't want to get too specific because maybe we can get you back just prior to that concert, but it is this one. It's the last one.
It is. And yeah, we decided that we wanted to do a show that was sort of some of our favorite music that we've played at the State Theater over the last 5 years. You know, cool. So we'll bring in some new music because we also want to give almost everybody in the band a chance to solo. Everyone who wants to solo is going to get one. Cool. So because we want to go out with a bang, we want people to have fond memories of our time at the State, and we want to give everyone in the band a chance to sort of show off a little bit if they choose to do so. Yeah, it's going to be a night of toe-tapping music without question and some really fun charts.
I wonder if there's a jazz version of something from Swan Lake being the Swan Song concert.
That's a good question. There's certainly other Tchaikovsky has been turned into jazz, so I would have to go look.
I think you should, yeah.
I think I should, too, yeah.
That whole Dying Swan thing, boy, done in with jazz would be.
Still might be really depressing, though.
I would think it might take the tear jerking aspect away. But.
Well, maybe I'll see what I can find.
So. Or more tears? Who knows?
this is entirely possible.
Friday Funktacular Backstage Show, Chippewa Valley Jazz Orchestra. Jeff Peterson, thank you.
Oh, thank you as always.
Friday night, 7:30, State Theater Backstage. Tickets at eauclairearts.com. You can save $5 by getting your ticket today. Chippewa Valley Jazz Orchestra, one of the jewels in our bauble-laden musical jewelry box. The Eau Claire Improv Festival's getting ready to bring you a special evening. That's next. Support for WPR comes from Chanhassen Dinner Theaters, performing Disney's new Broadway musical, Newsies, presented by Star Tribune, a high-energy song and dance celebration. More information is available at chanhassendt.com. Support also comes from Luther College in Decorah, Iowa, offering over 60 areas of study, including new majors in data science and neuroscience. Dedicated to preparing students for a changing world, luther.edu. Well, we're just a couple weeks away from the 6th annual Eau Claire Improv Festival, a one-night event that this year welcomes the leading name in improv preeminence, the Second City, in the form of their all-stars troupe coming to perform. To give you a heads up and provide much of what you need to know, we invited organizer and improv tutor Amber Dernbach, as well as Vernon Mina, one of those Second City all-stars. So, Vernon, guests... Special guests. Amber is a guest, but she's here every once in a while. So you're our special guest. You get to go first. You're listed on the Second City website with all the other M's, which includes guys like Tim Meadows, Colin Mockery, Bill Murray, and Mike Myers.
Everyone listed on our website is either alum, have gone through our training center, or has had active sort of performance on any one of our given stages.
And, of course, your bio, which is brief but informative, says you are Honduran. We're going to talk.
Right.
We're going to talk a little bit about Honduras. According to the internet, Honduras is known for many things like the world's highest murder rate, minerals, coffee, tropical fruit, sugarcane, and textiles. Now, I didn't see comedy on that list. Tell me about growing up funny in Honduras.
You know, it's really funny. I'll go back to the murder capital of the world. You know, it's unfortunate, but I do have sort of a funny situation where, you know, my parents immigrated over to the States and naturally found another place just as welcoming when it comes to press in regards to violence, Chicago. So I think it was a natural transition from Honduras to Chicago.
Wow,
Growing up sort of funny in Honduras, I come from a big family, and being the youngest of five and having plenty of cousins and uncles around me, I certainly didn't grow up in the internet age. So everyone kind of had stories, and we did impressions of each other, and there was always a funny uncle, and I had more than just a few. And so naturally, that just kind of rubbed off on me.
Wow. I've never been to Honduras, and I wonder if I ever will. Should I go?
Yeah, absolutely, especially if you want to check out a really tropical place, Roatan, which is an island off the coast of Honduras. It's kind of world-renowned for its coral reefs.
I expected you to sound Honduran.
Funny, yeah. Only when I speak in Spanish can you hear my accent.
Oh, well, say something.
¿Cómo que quieres oír?
Thanks for doing that. That was impromptu right there. You you have benefited from something called the Bob Curry Fellowship, designated for development. Tell me just a little bit about that.
Yeah, sure. So it's an annual sort of scholarship in the sense that it's an expedited program for anyone who's interested within the diversity category in our communities. You're Hispanic, you're African-American, you're gay, you're bi, trans, or any other particular category they have to fit in that isn't sort of considered mainstream. You have the opportunity to be taught by the master teachers at Second City and also the master classes. So you look at archival material from Second City. It's really a great opportunity to be sort of thrown into the process for people that potentially could become hired. And in fact, that's part of the reason why that program was created, is to give those particular people in that community voice to then be hired by the Second City soon afterwards.
How about the heritage of Second City? You know, next year, 2019, according to my math, it's going to be 60 years old. Are young guys like you consistently made aware of and appreciate the heritage of the place?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think for the majority of anyone who comes through those doors, I mean, you see the history the second you walk in, and founded in 1959. In fact, they have a bar and grill inside the building named just that, 1959. And there's tons of pictures everywhere. So you certainly get the wealth of importance when you walk inside the building.
That's cool. You know, Amber, it is quite an endorsement for this relatively young improv festival to have landed the likes of the Second City Improv All-Stars. Congratulations on
that.
And how excited are you guys?
We're thrilled. Yeah. We're going into our sixth year. Each year we've gotten more performers, more audience from our local community to express interest in improv and want to be a part of it.
How did this Second City thing all come about? How did you land these guys?
Well, last year you spoke with our featured guest, Jacob Shuda, who's a former student of mine from the Memorial Group, and he works for the Second City as a musical director, talking about the possibility of a traveling group this year that really led to this happening.
It's not what you know, it's who you know is really true.
True.
Now, the very cool thing about this Eau Claire Festival is that it covers all the levels of interaction, from the pros, from Chicago, the seasoned, from Minneapolis and Eau Claire, and even high school hatchlings.
Sure.
I call them hatchlings. and you're very familiar with those people.
Yeah.
Audiences are really going to be able to see improv development at work.
Yes, and that's important to me as a teacher and as a coach, to make sure that people see different levels and that there feels like there's an entryway for new faces.
Is it tough to get high school kids to try improv?
Oh, no. I always have way more students audition each year than I can take.
Really?
Really.
Why the limit?
Resources. Just if I have a team that's too large, I just can't give the attention to each performer that I really need to.
We're in the studio with Amber Dernbach, and she is one of the big cheeses with the 6th Annual Eau Claire Improv Festival, which comes up Saturday, April 14th. It's at the Metro in downtown Eau Claire. And Vernon Mina is on the phone. He is a member of The Second City. They are coming as special guests, Second City Improv All-Stars. Vernon, most of us have heard the yes and equation. Now, that, of course, is the seed from which improv grows. At your level, is it still that basic?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm also a teacher here at Second City, and it's one of the fundamental first day kind of idioms that we talk about in class, because you can't start a scene without accepting what the reality has already been given to you. So if someone comes into a scene and says, yeah, this traffic is sure awful, and then you start talking about, well, I don't know, I guess this factory is kind of a different situation, right? You sort of break the reality of what's occurring. So it immediately stops the scene in its infancy, and that's the reason why we want to make sure that it's established immediately and accepted immediately.
So now back at the very basic level, Amber, high school kids who are just coming into improv, what do you tell them about their ability to be spontaneous?
Well, we play, right? And so in addition to immediately starting with the yes and, like Vernon was talking about, I talk about giving gifts and loving who you're on stage with. And so by the time we have an audience in front of us, they've been able to get into the zone where they get into character, they're playing, they're only focused on what they're doing in that moment in time.
So Vernon, is there improv warm-up? Do you do something before you hit the stage?
Yeah, I think everyone kind of reacts to it differently. Certainly at this level of performance for the Second City, there is sort of a mantra that we do right before we get on. You know, we establish eye contact and we pat each other on the back and we say, you know, we have each other's back. I've got your back. I've got your back. Just to establish that whatever happens on stage, we're going to protect each other. We are going to have fun up there because we are a team and we're going up there enduring it together. As far as like physical warm-ups, you know, some people kind of go to their own corners and establish their own sense of calm before getting onto that stage. But certainly at lower levels, you've got physical warm-ups that you could do, just kind of shake the body up and get ready for what you're about to do.
Okay. Do improv people have off nights?
Meaning, you know, they just don't have a good, good show?
Do they come off stage and go, boy, that sucked?
Absolutely. Actually, Mick Napier has something that he says, you know, we love improv because it always works. And naturally, it's a joke because it doesn't. It's improv, you know, just like anything else. You might get a suggestion that you might not think quickly enough to establish in a scene and feel like, oh, we kind of lost the card on the track, as it were. So, yeah, absolutely. Just like anything else. But the more you do it, the more you kind of establish, oh, there's workarounds. Maybe I could have done this. So getting off stage and assessing those situations helps in the future.
Mm-hmm. Question for either of you guys. Improv, trying it. Why should someone try it and who should try it? Amber.
Well, I think that anyone who has the slightest interest should try it.
Interest in what? Making people laugh?
No, I wouldn't even think about making anybody laugh. I would think about establishing trust and being able to build a community with a group of people. And comedy might be the byproduct of that, but being comfortable, being extemporaneous.
So improv doesn't have to be funny?
No.
Okay, Vernon?
Yeah, I couldn't agree with Amber more. I think that's exactly right. That's what we teach. I mean, there's a difference between you doing a set where you're specifically, you know, making fun of satire, and that has its own purpose. But as far as what sorts of people should be doing improv, it's really anyone. And the fact of the matter is that we improvise all the time during the day, without having an audience. And sometimes we do have an audience, and that could be our family members and friends. But I think it's people going to improv because they want to get more comfortable speaking publicly or having a different self-assurance or awareness of themselves and just want somewhere to kind of have an outlet creatively. But it can come from all different places. And in regards to being funny, some of the best comedy comes out of just being honest and truthful on stage. And that's certainly something that we try to enforce at Second City as well.
It's got to be true that the longer you do it, the bigger arsenal you have.
The same thing goes with comedy and stories and music. You know, you all have the same chords, but you give it to a different person, they're going to do different things with it. The same thing could be said about comedy in that you could have the same suggestion, which is doctor and patient, which we get all the time, and I'm sure Amber
relates
to that. But what kind of doctor and patient is it? I'm going to have a different point of view, a different story to tell, a different kind of attitude to express on stage. And that's where it becomes interesting. And all the fact that it's spontaneous, you know, that spontaneity is really what drives some of the magic that happens on stage as well.
Is there a weirdest thing that an audience has suggested that was real tough to do but turned out to be magic?
I can think of a few instances where an audience member might suggest a particular famous person, but somebody who I wasn't really into, you know, somebody who is a pop culture figure, but maybe I've never actually seen that TV show or movie.
Uh-huh.
There are certainly some suggestions that we get a lot. For example, in the fall, you're always going to get something about the Packers. Just like Vernon said, Doctor and Patient, we get that all the time. Master and Dog. There's certain suggestions that we're just kind of used to having, or when we do shows at high school, there are certain people or certain places that get called out a lot. And I just tell my students, for example, if we hear Candyland again, right? Like we've heard that a lot. Well, we're just going to find a new avenue in that board game.
Vernon, you have the Bears.
That's right. We do have the Bears.
So anything weird that you can remember? You've been around the block a few times.
It is funny, interestingly enough, that some of it is seasonal. But some of the stuff can just be alcohol or that people just, you know, we do offer liquor in our shows. So people just have the courage to say things, some things that they typically wouldn't. As a matter of fact, this past weekend, we were doing a show for about 300 or so folks. And in a suggestion of a location that could fit on the stage, they yelled out Holocaust Museum, which obviously put both the performers on edge of, you know, how can we spin it? And they did the smartest thing they could possibly do as such, you know, at this level of performing. They started the scene with like, well, this is an interesting place for a first date. and immediately got the audience on their side.
Smart.
Yeah, that's good stuff. We've been talking with Vernon, and of course, Second City Improv All-Stars have been getting a lot of ink, if you can get ink on a radio show. but you have a couple other groups, several other, who are performing.
Yeah, we have three opening groups. Eau Claire Improv Company, which is a group that I perform with, and we're an amalgamation of improvisers from various groups that have been performing around Eau Claire for a while, Double X, Shambles, Improv Lab, and Memorial High School, so those are students that I coach, and Glassworks Improv. Recently moved to Minneapolis, but originally an Eau Claire group, three guys who used to be my students.
Vernon, Mina, thanks so much for being with us here on Spectrum West. We look forward to seeing you in Eau Claire.
Thank you so much for having me on. Amber,
see you soon, Vernon.
How about amenities? Is there food and beverages?
Yeah, there will be pizza available for purchase, and there will also be a bar.
That's what I do. See, when I where I improvise is around food and drink.
Yes, as do many people, right? Good. It's a night out.
Amber Dernbach, thanks.
Thank you so much, Al.
The 6th Annual Eau Claire Improv Festival, Saturday, April 14th. Think Mandarin Club or Boys and Girls Club. It's now the Metro. It's back to being a club where people congregate, perform, and have a good time. Doors open at 6:30. Show starts 7:30. Tickets online at ecimprovfest.com. Now we're putting next week's lineup together. It does already include... Ready for this? Citizens' Activism and Cultural Transformation in Creating Thriving Communities. There's a good chunk to chew on till we meet again. As well as a premier dance troupe that's going to cap a marvelous artist series, BJ Hollers might stop by with a look at the Chippewa Valley Writers Guild plate and more. Listen for announcements of other topics and guests next week. Here's a Spectrum memo for you, maybe a couple. Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts welcomes Hornucopia Saturday evening. Lane Yost, who does a tribute to the music of John Denver, will be there Saturday, April 14th. MabelTainter.org is that website. By the way, there's a Thai cooking class coming to UW-Barron County Wednesdays, April 4th, 11th, and 18th. You can register by tomorrow, Friday, online at ce.uwc.edu/Barron, or give them a call. The Eau Claire Regional Arts Center presents the exhibit State of the Arts in the Janet Carson Gallery, but only through tomorrow, Friday. Visual art that formed and influenced the Arts Council. It's a who's who of regional artists. And don't forget, Arts West 39 is now featured at the L.E. Phillips Library in Eau Claire through April 6th. Much obliged, Hannah, Dean, and Kate, for words, archives, photos, and editing. For Jim Oliver, I'm Al Ross. Sure has been fun. Let's do it again next week.